On this episode of Restore It All, we've got a new solution for the problem of ransomware attacking Windows-based backup servers. This one's aimed specifically at Veeam, but it looks like there are many other applications. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, and welcome to Backup Central's Restore It All podcast. I'm your host, W. Curtis Preston, a.k.a. Mr. Backup, and I have with me the guy that I think is going to help me find a new recording platform, Prasada Valiandi. How's it going, Prasada?
I'm good, Curtis. So I don't think it's all doom and gloom for the podcast recording platforms yet. We'll just have to wait and see.
Let me introduce today's guest. This is a unique one. I've known and known of our two guests today. And by the way, it's unique. We rarely have two guests. I'm going to have to figure out how to fit you on the Brady Bunch screen. I've known of one guest for almost as long as I've been in backups. And I was an admirer of his early work. And we'll talk about that a little bit. And then our other guest, I've known him for quite a while as well. And we've gotten in trouble a little bit here and there together. So first, I want to welcome the CEO of Grau Data, Herbert Grau. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, gentlemen, for inviting me.
And welcome, of course, to David Cerf. How's it going, David?
Very good, Curtis. Good to see you.
So by the way, the fact, you know, I knew that we were talking to Grau Data today, and I knew that, or at least I believed at the time, that you were the same company or a follow-on company from the company that I knew way back in the day. What I did not expect is to have a guest whose name matched the name of the company. So that was a big surprise to me. So let's go, Herbert, let's go back in the day. The first time I remember seeing you or hearing of your company were these gigantic tape libraries. And I remember back in the day looking at them going, that looks amazing. Like it was like they were just these ginormous tape libraries that here I was an early Spectralogic customer. And they had these little, you know, these little carousel things. So I was dealing with like 30 tapes and you were dealing with thousands of tapes. And I remember going, holy cow. And one thing I remember was that the libraries were so big and they were so cost effective that it actually, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. What I remember was that it actually cost more to fill it up with tape than it did to buy the library itself, right? The library was so large and so cost-effective that that was the case. You want to talk a little bit about those old days?
Yep. Well, I started already very early in the 1980s. Our background was machine building. So I took the company from my father and we were automotive suppliers and machine builders. So we were not an IT company. And IBM brought this tape to the market and had no automation. And StorageTek was already there, and IBM had nothing. So we filled that gap and built a tape library. In the first days, weird enough, without any software connected to the host. This came over time through the customers. But we have been building these really cool tape libraries, and they were called mixed media libraries, because we could automate anybody's tape drives from Hitachi, from other vendors as well, even in a mixed mode. And so we were the exact counterpart of StorageTek, all from us.
Right.
And we had kind of more an open approach. And the second generation, we introduced a Quattro Tower. This was a cool patent we had. On one surface, the cartridges were moving inside small towers. So we could have 5,000 IBM cartridges on a small footprint. And we were shipping tape libraries around the world when EMS joined my company. And a very large library would have 30,000 IBM tapes. So six of these towers in a row, and a tape robot, a traveling, moving robot on one side, and if necessary, on the second side. So we had a double robot system and 30,000 tapes in a row. And what we also could do, we had a special tape format implemented called D2, which only the U.S. government had. If you want, I still have on my drawer here a D2 tape from these days, and we converted our tape libraries to this special technology, and then we shipped through EMS to the famous unknown customers, to the famous government agency under us. The NSA bought in 1995 a tape library with a capacity of 400 terabytes. At that time, my biggest customer, the Deutsche Bank, had 5.
Wow.
And we said, holy cow, who in the world needs 400 terabyte and what for? But then somebody from EMS explained me what these guys were doing, all these satellites in the Iraq, and they had 8 supercomputers from Cray, and disk was awfully expensive. So all this data came from satellites in Longley or whatever, down to Earth in this data center underground, and 8 supercomputers, and then an HSM of the early days called FileSurf. I think Quantum is still selling this today. And FileSurf moving data. FileSurf and moving data to tape out. And this was, of course, a breakthrough for my small company, because then we sold big time machines to the DoD and in the US, of course. Unfortunately, then EMS, actually the mother company of EMS, E-Systems, got bought by Raytheon. So the missile buys the satellite. And then the whole thing got difficult, and they wanted to sell this off, and I couldn't buy my company back. So I sold my remaining shares then to ADIC, bought then EMS. And I had restarted Crowd Data in Germany. Again, sold my shares, and 2 weeks later, I was on the market again with a new company, Crowd Data, which is the company today, because then my old name was not so important anymore, because EMS wanted to have EMS data storage, and I was Crowd Data Storage. Mm-hmm. Eddie wanted to get me back, but then I said, no, I do it on my own. And then we entered the market first, again with a tape library called InfiniStore, but this was already an appliance. Software, server, disk, and tape in one device.
Mm-hmm.
And we sold this nicely in Germany until one point in time, it was not possible anymore for a small company to sell hardware. And then we had extremely nice products, hardware products, tape libraries, new generation, smaller, easy, lean, cost-effective, but we had to sell this. And then I met David. This was about 2007. And then I restarted the company again, the same company, but I restarted as a software company.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then, of course, tape, HSM was our background. So we had a product which even HPE OEM'd. It was on their price list as file system extender. But not very successful, because HPE was in the turmoil, so many products, and we kind of were sitting between the chairs. And then HPE stopped the contract, and we sold it under the Crowd logo. And over time, we worked our portfolio, and in the last 4 years, we have developed a complete, almost complete new product portfolio, which now looks really good. And that's why I'm in the mode of re-entering to the U.S. with my friend David and sell our nice products to the U.S. And I've been coming and traveling all along the last years. Still have partners and friends and no customers anymore, but this will hopefully change soon.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, David, you know, when we started talking about, you know, I discovered this other product, this newer product, right? And I had no idea, right? Because I think this latest product is absolutely going after a problem that is really important, right? The slight problem called ransomware, right? In fact, I just a week ago, I came out with an article in Network World that talks, the title was ransomware is coming for your backups, right? It's coming for your backup server specifically. And this latest product is aiming at solving that really new challenging problem. I had no idea when we started talking that we were going to be talking about a person that I've been involved with for 30 years. David, what do you think? What's your goal as you move this company in, you know, into the U.S. or to expand it into the U.S.?
Well, Curtis, the phase we're at is awareness, first of all. I think it was funny how we did re-loop together, which was that Dave Russell and I were talking, and he had mentioned he had heard this podcast talking about Blocky for Beam,
right,
which is the product you were just mentioning.
Right.
And he didn't mention it was you.
Yeah.
And so I had to go look it up, and then I was it's Curtis. Wow. And so we reached out. And so there's the point is that awareness issue is that Grau has done exceptionally well in Europe, working with channel partners and around the customer base for Veeam, because as you mentioned, ransomware is such a critical issue right now. And the way the Blocky product works is a zero trust that it really brings a level of security to the largest install base for Veeam or these Windows users. And this gives them a very simple, easy to deploy, quick solution. And that went like wildfire through the reseller partners. So Europe behaves a little different, right? Channels operate a little differently than American channels and resellers. And so they've done incredibly well with this traction and awareness. So we'd like to bring that awareness and that success out of Europe, and not just to North America, but globally, because, you know, Veeam, of course, is global, has a really strong footprint in South America and Asia, and you have and the majority of their customers are Windows users. So getting that message out would certainly be the goal. And I think the product speaks for itself, because there are no real options. It's either I have Windows and I do something, or I don't. And we're that something you can do to bring security and cyber resilience.
Currently, we have four products, three of them almost brand new. And we have a product which we sell since many years very successfully. It's called FileLock. It's a Windows-based software for compliant archiving. And we have a KPMG certificate that nobody can alter data after it has been archived. And we have sold this product about 1,500 times in Europe. And it's based on the filter driver technology. And it's embedded in Windows, so you can have it on a Windows server. Very simple, on a physical or virtual machine. Just install the software, and this filter driver makes sure nobody, not even the admin, can alter data which is supposed to be archived for 10 years or whatever. It has the same API as the SnapLock API from NetApp. Okay?
Oh, that's one that Persona should know.
And the SnapLock was the role model, and this API is not protected. So we have the same API, single file retention like a SnapLock. But we are independent, we run on the Windows server, and we scale as much Windows scales from 100 gigabyte for a small company to multiple terabyte in large sites. Cluster ready, everything. And this product is pretty cool and stable, because filter driver technology was not so stable 20 years ago. We produced blue screens in the very early days. All the Veeam guys asked me that. But since Microsoft introduced the mini filter technology, so an official interface for filters. More than 10 years, we have zero problems with the product. Very cool product, very lean. And one customer said, Herbert, data in FireLock cannot be altered by nobody, not even by ransomware. That's cool. But I cannot buy a compliant archive for my data. I mean, the backup should be able to override it. So we took this idea and said we create a new product called Blocky. And this is like a filter driver. This is like a sheet metal plate, a warm shield. Nobody can go through it. And then we drill a small hole. And in the small hole, one guy says, nobody can pass except the Veeam application. And if the Veeam application comes, this application always has to show a passport and a fingerprint, like if I enter the US. Okay? And that's why we can block everybody, even the good and the bad, except the one application which we whitelist. And that was Blocky. We also have for IBM TSM a big customer, but this was the first one. And the selling was word on mouth. Customer said, wow, it's explained in 20 minutes. It's installed in 10 minutes. It's so effective, costs less, and is really cool and effective. And that's why we sold 500 customers only in German-speaking countries in the last 4 years. Among them, pretty big names. From small SOHO customers to really, really large international corporations. And that was really a home run for us, because we could use the technology which was proven over many, many years to a different field.
And so it sounds like this grew out of the audit proof archiving line that you had, the file lock from there.
Yep.
And then you've also got a couple of other products. You talk about metadata mining and the tape object archive. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, of course, tape is our background, as we talked. And tape will never go away. So we have a product which we have on the market since almost 20 years now. Is a stable product, but a bit aged, classical tape HSM, like other products. And we have customers, big customers, like Max Planck Institute with multiple petabyte and 10 of these. And we have a legacy installed base. And some time ago, we decided that we do a new architecture because we think tape will never go away next whatever years. It's a niche market. Right. But we are an expert in this niche market, and I have customers which I want to lead to the next generation. And that's why we developed a product called Extreme Store. And this is now an object storage product. It's a scalable object storage software with S3 to tape. That's the difference. And with this
I interface with it via the S3 protocol, correct, and then you correct. Put it on tape.
Yep. Maybe you know the Black Pearl from Spectralogic, because we mentioned that name.
Right.
And that's kind of a product. Well, we compete not so much in Germany, but in the US, this would be our major competitor. But this is a market where only very few companies play. In Europe, I see two. And we have, I think, the best architecture. We have a scalable architecture. We have a no SQL database. We can scale this vertically into multi-billions and horizontally into multi-servers. And important in the tape world, if you have very small files and you have billions, you have to do containers. You cannot put small files on tape and retrieve a billion files from tape without containers. And that's why this container technology is important. And we recently did a test in a partner data center of 1.5 billion files in one bucket. And this is endless scalable. That's important.
Nice.
And then, of course, we have a modern web UI. Some guys like still the command line interface, but more and more the younger guys on the web UI. And so we have some cool things around the product, which is in this niche, a cool product. And now I have mentioned three, and the three would normally be good enough for a company Crowdata with 30 people having an archival background. But I have a new product, and that's really a cool product, and that's called the Metadata Hub. Why do I have this product? Because my friend David Cerf came 4 years ago. He was just leaving his beloved company, Strongbox, and said, Herbert, you have to look at metadata. Yeah. And I said, why? This is old stuff. Metadata is old stuff. Because we use metadata like everybody else since 20 years. File size and last access, and this is HSM of old school.
Yeah.
But if I explain you today that we have a very unique product, people say, how can that be? Because if you Google metadata, you find so many products which mention this. You have to define metadata as standard file system metadata, which is simple.
Not as useful.
It's useful for many virus scanners and everybody, but it's simple.
Yeah.
And then we have embedded metadata. And then you take very special file formats. And you go to a research lab, you go to a Max Planck Institute, which partners with Harvard, and they want a special file format which comes from the NASA, NIFTY file. What is that? And then you look into this NIFTY file, for example, and this file has 10,000 metadata tags. Holy cow, 10,000. And we have developed a technology how to extract these 10,000 embedded metadata tags and write them into a huge database. And now the research guy can say, I need all files which have this whatever dimension here and this dimension there. He does a Google kind of complex search. And out of his 10 million files, which are somewhere, he gets the right 2,000 files. And he can narrow this down from 10,000 to 5,000, 2,000. And then he has the right data. Yeah. And that's our job, find the right data. And we deliver them the right data to a KI platform, to an algorithm, to improve it and whatnot. Because I have also another company which is doing only medical data, and we have huge amount of data, but you always need the right amount, the right data. And that's the job of the metadata hub. And then we go to the next one. This institute has a microscope from Zeiss, very special file format. Holy cow, 8,000 metadata tags. Next one, bioinformatic. I never heard these names before. But now we have a technology how to extract this. That's why I call it deep data mining. We drill holes very, very deep. Same is in automotive. In Stuttgart, there's a company, a car company. We have some of these here. And they have a motor test equipment. And this is spitting out files. And then we go there and they said, you know what? We would like to know which of these million files have the same parameter for minus 30 degrees, that amount of kilometer, and blah, blah, blah. And I said, you don't know that? No, how should we? Nobody can do this manually, and nobody can extract the data. So we build an extractor for this special file format. And that's why we are unique.
And
you know, David, you it sounds like you sort of brought up this idea. I'm a little bit like that last customer where how is this not already everywhere?
David told me. David explained me his product, which was a different product. This was all about storage management. All products are metadata for storage management. Move data around, get rid of the isolation, get an NetApp in. Mm-hmm. And all this is about storage. And I said, I want to get out of storage. I don't want to sell terabytes anymore. I want to be in the analytics business. I want a Google-like for metadata. This is a different game. And we will go direction to artificial intelligence in the next steps. So we will move completely away from this, how many data is here and on the island, and move this back and forth, and this is old and cold. This is kind of done.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about use cases other than that. I know the primary use cases you talked about, but just thinking about things like, I know, Curtis, we always talk about archive, right? And how do you find what spin archive because you don't know what server it came from, right? You no longer have that storage perspective, right? And or even things like e-discovery like use cases where it's like, hey, tell me information related to this subject or other things like that. It seems like what you've built, Herbert and David, is sort of an ability to centralize all of these different file formats or unique file formats and provide that value to the customer so they can run these queries on their own.
So absolutely. And yeah, I had actually, David went to a Berlin research lab and kind of sold them the idea, but the product was not there. Mm. And I sold him the product now for a nice amount of money. And he was, Mr. Grau, finally I have a product. I've been waiting 3 years for a product. And I said to my guys, maybe we have a unique selling point here because this guy is searching the market for 3 years in the US and everywhere. And he didn't find at least one product which could do the job.
So there are two separate ways to look at it. One, Herbert has outlined very well, which is we're trying to understand how to drive our business intelligence. How do we, and that's really in the application space, which is this ability to extract that metadata to have better insights and understanding and visibility, which has really nothing to do with where the file may be stored. But what there's a second use case, which is almost secondary, which is if I actually can understand what I have, then I can apply that to what I do with it by number of copies, or does it need to have certain compliance, or where do I keep it? How long do I keep it? So that was the origin of where I had come from, was more in the extract that metadata. So the world, you could look, you know, if we, with hindsight, we can say, hey, we knew we had to have metadata to be able to drive the intelligence that we want to drive through AI and machine learning. You can't get there without it. And so the difference would be is the approach to it. And so the elegance that's in the metadata hub is really that simplicity. Separate out the overhead that comes with the file management or trying to put a global namespace and all the other things that what Herbert was referencing, what I was trying to do, which was kind of all these various things, and just focus really on the metadata. And so there are two really interesting things that were solved with this, which Herbert said, but let me just emphasize it. One is this rapid development capability for connecting to the file type. This was really a showstopper, because if I have these unique elements and these customers could not connect to it, then it didn't matter what you would do. You had to solve that first. So Grau has solved that ability to A, connect. So that was the first part. And then the second part was on the backside, which is, okay, I've done the extraction. So this is almost like, think of ETL in databases, right? Extract, transform, and load. And except for with the metadata hub, we're extracting, we're transforming, and then we're connecting. And so either we allow through our native user interfaces a way for the user to just be able to directly access, but more importantly, is that we can connect to the tools that they're already using. And so this really creates this feed to where they can leverage that data to drive that business, accelerate what they're trying to do, which, because that's really what it's all about at the end of the day, right? They have a problem to solve, and we're helping them solve that.
So speaking about what it's all about, let's get to the star of the show, I think, here, in terms of this podcast. You know, we've talked a lot. We've had Dave on. You know, we've talked a lot about Veeam. We've talked a lot about just Windows-based backup systems. Veeam being, you know, Veeam and Commvault would be the two biggest examples, right? And the risk, I think, that their customers are under, because Windows being, as we all know, the number one attack vector for ransomware, right? And so the worry is that, you know, It's been a while since I've installed Veeam for obvious reasons. But by the way, I haven't thrown out our usual disclaimer. This is an independent podcast. I work for Druva. Persona works for Zoom. And this is not a podcast of either company. And the opinions that you hear are ours. And also, be sure to rate us by going to the, you know, your favorite podcast app. Give us some stars. Give us some comments.
Leave that some helps comments.
Other people find this podcast. Yeah. Absolutely. Feel free to tweet as long as Twitter is still
it's still around.
And if you'd like to if you'd like to join the conversation, you can find me at WC Preston on Twitter or WCurtisPreston at Gmail. And we'd love to get you on the podcast. So, you know, this concern, right, specifically like the default installation is on a Windows-based backup server, right? And then and even the main, even if you use Linux as another storage device, the main server is still on Windows. And they do have this, the Linux-based storage device now as an answer to this.
Obviously with their hard Linux server does create a very robust option. I think the real differentiation, Curtis, is the customers. When you look at how many Veeam customers are using Linux, when you look at their customer, you know, demographics, it's broken out as the majority, the big majority are Windows users. And a large part of those customers aren't going to put a Linux server in, because, you know, the guy that's running this, he's a Windows guy, and I'm not, you know, it's a religion thing almost at some point. And the larger corporations, it's out of simplicity. As Herbert mentioned, we've got several global international companies, and they have maybe 100 plus sites, and they're not going to run this with this complex deployment. And where the blocky for Veeam comes in is, it's, as Herbert mentioned, you're talking about from the moment you learn about it to installing it is less than an hour. So the simplicity makes it really easy for the Windows guys that don't have to do anything different. And now they have a level of security for protecting that Windows backup volume and repository, right? So I think that's really where the line of demarcation comes down to, is if you're a data center and you're running a Linux environment and you're comfortable with that, you might go with the native Veeam hardened Linux solution. For those customers that don't, that's where we shine. And we provide that easy, quick install that gives that level of protection against ransomware.
And we've talked about that. That was one of my concerns as well, the one that you brought in. If you're an all Windows shop, I'm not sure even if the Linux option is more secure than having another Windows box, I'm not sure if it is more secure because it's your only Linux box.
Right.
If it's the only Linux box in your data center, I don't think that's a good idea. If it was your only Windows box in the data center, I don't think that's a good idea, right? Just having a separate OS that you have to maintain just for a single purpose, you know, I've never been a fan of that. But why don't you give a little bit more about how, so, you know, it sounds like the product is incredibly simple to explain. David, do you want to give an overview? It sounds like pretty easy to explain, and Herbert's already given us an overview. You want to drill down a little bit?
Sure. So, maybe pick up where your comment about people adding something to their environment. I think that's the real challenge, is it the IT, and now if you add the security layer, whether it's the CISO, CSO, whatever they're doing, as long as we're not talking about the hardened physical, these guys are overwhelmed. I mean, ransomware is not a matter of if it will happen. It's a matter of when it will happen. I think we've reached that point, and everybody else has, you know, confirmed that it's going to be a risk that they have to deal with. And so when they're looking for a solution, what we're finding is that the antivirus and all these other type of tools that are out there are really not able to provide a way to protect that last resort, which is your backup. So when the virus gets in, it's sitting there, and the first thing they're going to go after are those backup files, right? So they're going to go disable that, attack that, and at some point later, right, because it could be a Trojan horse where it's sitting there waiting, and then it comes on, you've got this this problem is that you're at the mercy of whoever the attacker was and what their demand is. And this is where the blocky really comes in. As Herbert mentioned, what we're creating is a way to have cyber resiliency through zero trust. So when you enable blocky, which is a simple download, so you download it, it installs in less than 20 minutes. The first thing it's going to do is it's going to say, what is the trust? We're going to go right to creating the whitelist. And that whitelist is the trusted applications or process, I should say, because it's Veeam in this case. And I'll leave a caveat here, is that the way Growl built blocky as a technology, it can be applied to other applications. We've really focused on the use case around Veeam. So in general, you could say I have other applications and allow other application access, but the way we've tuned this to the Veeam market is Veeam specific. And so the only processes that you're really trying to identify is what's going to happen from the Veeam process to access that repository. So the first thing you do is either you manually set that, or we have an auto, you can literally turn on the auto discover, and we'll discover those processes. It's within, you set a period, let's say 24 hours, you run your backup, we know the process, you turn that off, and then at that moment, we're at zero trust. And so nothing else is going to go back in from a ransomware perspective and alter, modify, or delete, because we've now applied that worm. And for those, just to clarify, write once, read many, right? And that nothing's going to alter. It's immutable at this point, and you're now secure. So even if you had ransomware that was already in the system, at this point, they can't alter or modify those files. So reading the file out is simple, and verifying with through the fingerprint, where we actually capture all the related elements to that process, including the DLLs, and that is combined to create that unique identifying fingerprint. So every time there's a request to modify or write, hey, we're checking that. And if it's not an approved trusted application, we'll alert to it. And so now you get two benefits here. One is you've got the security through the protection of blocky. But second, now you've got some alerting. This is something that kind of caught me by surprise when Herbert said, hey, let's check this out. Was the first customer I talked to is they're like, wow, I've got a list. I could see my applications that are trying to hit that repository, and they can now get some reporting and visibility, transparency, and what's going on in their system. And they could take action from that as well.
Anything outside of the already approved application would trigger an alert, I'm assuming.
Correct. Thanks for clarity on that. Correct. So they can now see, hey, look, we've had these declined items. And so the admin now has some security. The second thing we did is we decoupled it. So it's not tied to the Veeam's passwords and those admin passwords. It has a separate independent. So it has that ability to operate without a risk of global password type settings. And then of course the last
part, I like that part.
Yeah.
I know we always talk about, Curtis, about don't put your backup servers on the same AD, right, as everything else. Yeah. So I'm glad
that you guys are going a step further and separating it.
I'm glad you guys are going a step further and not even having like the normal Veeam passwords as this authentication mechanism, because you really do want that more secure than everything else.
Absolutely. All right. This is your last resort, right? And that's really the key, is that why do we back up? We back up because only when we absolutely need that data, and if they take that down. So the blocky provides that additional layer of security and protection. And it works, of course. We have the ability to single site, multi-site, and so it provides this really simple way for whoever is managing either the IT stack or the security stack to add a layer into a product that is fantastic, right? I mean, Veeam is proven globally and customers love it, but now they can have that additional protection.
Maybe one more comment from my side. People ask me, what's the performance impact if I have blocky installed?
That's an important question.
Yep. The answer is, while writing and reading, zero. We don't do nothing. It's not like a virus kernel which always holds the process and then does not recognize the bad guy. So we do nothing while writing and reading. When it's deleting or modifying. We hold the process and check it, because that's the purpose of Blocky. And then we have maybe a 2 to 3% overhead while deleting and modifying. And that's a cool combination.
Yeah. Well, and especially because deleting and modifying isn't your predominant operation, right?
When you're doing backup. Of course not. And if this happens, you want somebody to check it.
Yeah.
Yes, agreed. Now, one question that I have, this will be my toughest question. Is there a way to defeat this product? So if I have admin on the box, what am I able to do? I know if the product is installed.
If you want an honest answer, I can give you the honest answer. An admin can destroy the whole Windows machine.
Right.
And that's not possible to avoid, neither from Veeam, not from Grau, not from Microsoft today.
Right. That's a pretty honest answer. Does that mean also that they could uninstall the product?
The uninstall is protected.
Okay. How?
The uninstall was a weak point 2 years ago, and that's protected.
Okay. How? I don't want to get into secret sauce, but how? In what way? Like, how do you protect that?
You need a password to go back and install. I mean, I think the real security here is if you have the admin and they blow the box away, they blow the box away. I mean, so that's a physical security issue potentially, right?
I think what I'm concerned about is not somebody who's, you know, so we've got a malware in there, we've got a bad actor in there, and they're trying to surreptitiously access data that they're not supposed to access, right? So they would want to disable this tool. And it sounds like that without the username and password from that tool, they wouldn't be able to do that.
Right. I mean, so
because blowing up the box, they would obviously show their hand, right? So they're not likely to do that. What they're likely to do is to try to disable anything that's trying to block their access.
Maybe one interesting point is that we have sold Blocky also to one very large customer in Stuttgart, which has 100 IBM backup servers from TSM, now Spectrum Scale. And that's a huge environment. And this is a corporate license we sold here. We're very, very proud about this. You may understand that we cannot give names out because in this ransomware world, nobody wants to read his name anywhere. But the point is that in the deep, in the TSM world, I still call it TSM, and Curtis, you know, maybe you too.
Yeah, me too.
The old guys, because we still call it TSM.
I still call it ADSM.
ADSM, by the way, Herbert. Who knows that?
Yeah.
You know? But in the TSM world, there's also always a DB2 coming with the product. And what was cool from my side is that we can also protect the DB2 data. Which opens potentially a market to applications that we also protect the database.
Yeah.
Data.
Exactly.
That's our next step, potentially.
And by the way, that customer also had Veeam.
Applications.
Oh, I'm sorry, Herbert.
Sorry?
I was just going to say that same customer, not just did they have TSM, but they also have Veeam. So they're happy.
Well, most customers which have TSM have other products. Other things, too.
Right. Yep.
so they're now that they're secure on their TSM, add the additional protection to their Veeam is where they're heading next as well.
Well, I want to thank you for this has been a really good discussion. I've learned more about the obviously about all of the products that you do. We focused in on the end here on Blocky for Veeam. And I think you've got a tremendous potential market. It has a lot of customers, and every one of them has a Windows server that needs protecting. So I wish you the best of luck. And thanks so much for allowing us to stand between you and a beer, Herbert.
Yeah. Actually, it's a bottle of wine today.
Yeah.
Oh, even better. Nice. All right. Something from the Rhine region, perhaps?
Yeah.
Could be Rhine, could be Mosel. You know, we have some valleys here.
Okay. Thanks a lot, everybody, for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having us. Appreciate the discussion.
Thanks, Curtis. Thanks, Prasanna.
Thank you all. Yes, great.
Absolutely. And again, as always, we'll remember to thank our listeners and be sure to subscribe so that you can restore it all.